Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Ramita Navai is an award-winning British-Iranian journalist and author. She has reported from more than 35 countries. She has this reputation for investigations and work in hostile environments, and her work on the upcoming front line is no exception. Navai goes inside Iraq to places where journalists have been, quite recently, killed for their work. She uses cell phone cameras and on-the-ground reporting and undercover work to examine the power of the militias in Iraq right now. She asks questions of high-ranking officials, and frankly, none of them seem to have good answers. Ramita Navai joins us now via phone from London. Welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Would you set the stage for our listeners here in South Dakota quickly? Tell us, we're in Iraq, we have ISIS holding territory, we have the police, the government, and then these militias. How can you help sort that all out to begin with?
Yeah, so visually, what really struck me, you're in Iraq and this country is in ruins. We traveled the length and breadth of it, and I have never seen so much destruction. I was really quite struck by that. Mm-hmm. You've also got the fight that's going on front lines that you can visually see, fighting between army and ISIS. And you've also got all these other front lines that you don't see on the news. So we were with the Shia militia in this mountainous area south of Mosul, and there's pretty fierce fighting that happens there. And you've got ISIS sleeper cells throughout the country.
So as there's still people fleeing from all of this. There's still sort of families, women, children, fathers, brothers walking. And then there's this huge sense of having to separate the men from the women. Tell me what the militia are looking for when they come across these sort of, you know, citizens who are just trying to find a safe place to be.
Yeah, that's another thing that you see is people on the move, people fleeing. There are over 3 million Iraqis now that have been internally displaced. And they live in refugee camps, they're on the move. And we went out with a Shia militia unit when a load of refugees, a load of Iraqis had fled from ISIS territory. It was an ISIS-held town called Hawija. And the militia went to pick them up. And these families, you know, tiny children had been walking 18 hours. They'd been shot at as they tried to leave by ISIS. They were absolutely exhausted, and they were pretty terrified. They'd escaped ISIS, and now they were walking straight into the hands of the Shia militia. And the Shia militia were pretty scared of them, too, because ISIS fighters are known to hide in among these refugees. And while we were there, the refugees pointed a guy out and said he was a collaborator. He was working with ISIS, and he was swiftly taken away by the Shia militias. But what seems to be happening is that the Shia militias, first of all, they separate the men, and they go through this screening, very legitimate screening process. They have a list of names of collaborators and ISIS fighters, and they check ID cards with this list of names. But what seems to be happening is that lots of ordinary Sunni civilians are getting scooped up in the process and are being held in a series of secret prisons, this network of prisons, and nobody really knows the locations of half these prisons. And they're being held without any judicial process.
Is there a judicial process that they should be going through and they're just not? Has it all been suspended or has it not really existed in Iraq?
Well, legally, it is in law that that the turnover has to be really quick, that they should not be held for more than about 24, 48 hours. However, one of these prisons, we managed to get to one of these prisons. The Shia militia actually took us and said, look, we're not hiding anything. But the militiamen there told us that these prisoners, and they were crammed into this room, these prisoners had been held there for 3 months, and that's not legal. And of course, what they showed us was what they were happy to show us. The prisoners looked terrified, but they didn't look like they'd been beaten, and they looked like they were being fed. But of course, the stories we've been hearing are of all the prisons where people are being tortured and beaten.
You're telling a very broad political story. But also there are these really compelling moments where you're sitting here listening to, for example, some women who are expressing to you their grief, their sorrow, their anger, their frustration. What was it like for you to sort of stand among these large groups of women who are confused and who are mourning and who are becoming quickly hopeless?
You know, in that moment, actually, I really understood the sense of absolute disenfranchisement that so many Sinis feel and the sense of powerlessness. And you understand it in those moments, in those very real, visceral moments. And of course, the bigger picture, we have analysts, we talk to analysts and we have people telling us and academics and intellectuals who say to us, listen, you can beat ISIS, but you're not going to beat Sunni insurgency. This problem will continue. This sectarian violence will continue until Sunnis feel like they have a stake in their government and their future and a piece of the political pie. And it's those moments when you're standing with the women who say, we've gone to the government offices and we get turned back every day. In those moments, that it becomes very real.
You ask one gentleman, has this changed the way you feel about your country? And I'm wondering why you asked him that.
Because there was so much hope. And this is what a lot of Iraqis talked to me about after Al-Qaeda was beaten, after the awakening campaign that the Americans were part of, where many important Sunni sheikhs were brought on side with the Americans to turn against Al-Qaeda. And there were promises that the Sunnis would be given a stake in government, they would be given a place at the table. And there was hope. And that hope has been shattered. And I spoke to so many Sunnis who no longer felt that this was their country. Because not only were they running from ISIS, now they were living in fear of the very government, the very power, the very people who were meant to protect them, and that includes the Shia militia. And so many men said to me, I don't feel that this is my country anymore. And it was bleak. You know, the big question is reconciliation. Is there a hope for reconciliation?
Is there, in your opinion? Do you see seeds of that, or is this something that is going to get worse?
I think there is hope. I'm a hopeful person.
Right.
I think there is hope, but not, you know, that's not an empty sentence for me. The reason I think there is hope is because there is a way around this. And the way around this is for Sunnis to be brought into the fold. That's the key. And I think what's important for the West to realize is that fighting ISIS won't be an end to Sunni insurgencies and Sunni extremist terrorist groups like ISIS. You have to get to the root of the problem, and that is fulfilling promises to the Sunni community and making Sunnis feel they have a stake in the future of their country.
Can you articulate for people who don't really understand the difference between Sunni and Shia in a way that sort of makes sense to us?
Sure. I mean, a really simplistic comparison. I know some people don't like this, but it's Catholic and Protestant, I think. And if you look at Iraq, about 60% of the country are Shias, and about 40% are Muslims. And what happened is that during Saddam's time, Saddam, even though he was secular, he was a Sunni, and so the minority Sunnis were in power. The invasion, U.S. invasion, happened. And all of these Sunnis, a process called de-Baathification happened. So anybody who was a member of Saddam's party, the Ba'ath Party, was fired, was sacked. So all of a sudden you had tens of thousands of Sunni men, no jobs, no income, no way to feed their families. And Shias took power, and Shias have had power ever since.
And who is the Badr organization?
The Badr organization are one of probably Iraq's biggest Shia militia group. They're headed by a man called Hadi al-Amiri. He is a pretty powerful man. He's really close to Iran. And they get technical support from Iran. They get training from Iran. And people say that Hadi Amiri has political ambitions. Certainly, the Badr organization have many supporters in government.
And so what are the implications of that support from Iran within Iraq? Is that significant?
I think it is significant because Iran, first of all, is very keen to have proxies in Iraq. It's very keen to make sure that there's a corridor that runs from Iran all the way to Syria. As we know, Iran is fighting in Syria on President Assad's side. What we know is that there's a Shia militia group called the Sayyid Shuhada Brigades who are funded by Iran, and Iran has sent them fighting in Syria, an Iraqi militia funded by Iran fighting in Syria. So there are kind of regional ambitions that some of these Iraqi militia groups have as well, and they want to be seen as protectors of Shia rights within the region.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ramita Navai. You can see the Frontline Iraq Uncovered on SDPB TV tomorrow night. And Ramita, I'm wondering what's happening to these men who have disappeared. Are bodies turning up? Are they out there somewhere?
Sometimes bodies do turn up. The cases that we covered, the 640 men, 43 men, who were taken into the desert. This is during fighting when the army was fighting ISIS in Fallujah. Originally, about 1,300, 400 men were rounded up, imprisoned, and 643 of those men were taken into the desert, and they have never been seen again. There's testimony from the men who were released from the prisons. I spoke to one of them. They were badly tortured. Some of them were died of torture. Some of them were executed. There are also cases of thousands of Sunni men disappearing at checkpoints. There's one checkpoint in particular we looked at. Over 2,000 men have been taken from this checkpoint. We know that it's manned by a Shia militia called Kataib Hezbollah. They have very close ties to Iran. They're probably one of the most secretive of all the militia groups. What we know is that over 2,000 men have been taken to secret prisons in a town called Jorf al-Sakha, which is east of this checkpoint, southeast of this checkpoint. And about 50, 60 of these men were released. And we spoke to two of the men who'd been held in this prison. Nobody knows why they were released. And they endured horrific torture. Nobody knows what's happened to the over 1,000, 2,000 men who are still being held in that network of prisons.
How risky was it for those men to talk to you?
They were terrified, really terrified. We were very careful. You know, there's no electronic trail. We met them in safe locations. We didn't film their faces, and were changing their voices. And nearly all of the men we talked to who had dealings with the Shia militia were warned, if you ever talk about what happened, we will hunt you down and we'll kill you.
Tell us what it's like for you and your crew to sort of travel through Iraq and some of the different, you know, measures that you have to take for your own safety.
I was quite surprised, actually, at how inaccessible a lot of the country is for Westerners. So you can cover kind of front lines like Mosul, because you can get an embed with the army or even with the militia. We went on embeds with the militia. They see themselves, of course, as a legitimate fighting force. In some respects, they are. They now answer directly to the prime minister. But if you want to go to other parts of the country, let's say Anbar, that's when it starts to get tricky. Because there are still ISIS sleeping cells everywhere. In Baghdad, something that surprised me was nearly every single day there's a bomb in Baghdad that goes off somewhere in the city or on the outskirts of the city. So security is a constant concern, especially as our director, Paddy, is very tall, blonde Englishman. So he does stick out. So There was one trip that we decided that it wasn't safe to take him in. So I went in with our Iraqi producer, Mace. Mace and I put on our headscarves and we put on our abayas, those long, big, black, kind of cloaky robes. And we went in without Paddy.
What was that experience like for you? Does that, you know, how do you keep doing this work? And you know, I guess what I want to know is if you were scared. I guess that's a silly question, but I keep coming back to it in my mind.
We were very careful and we take calculated risks. The moments that I do get scared, and there were a few moments where, yeah, you feel a little bit uncomfortable, especially when we were in Diyala, is when the locals get scared. So we were taken in by, they were Shia guides, and they were so upset at what was happening to their Sunni neighbors, at what the Shia militia were doing in their name, that that's why they took us in. They wanted to expose what's happening. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's dangerous even for them. You know, every now and again, there'd be kind of bursts of gunfire. This is completely ordinary for them, and this isn't a front line. You'd be going through these villages and there'd be bursts of gunfire and there'd be fighting. And sunset, locals in Diyala province, in many parts of Diyala province, don't feel safe traveling after sunset. So they were very keen to get us out when it did come to when it was sunset, when the sun went down. And then you realize, you know, we're coming in and we're leaving, whereas they stay behind. They live through this. Bombs every day. If you're in Baghdad, parts of Baghdad, you know, so many parts of the country that are not safe, even if you are an Iraqi and you are a local.
You mentioned, you know, Sunni Shia. Do they ever work together? Do you see signs of cooperation and of people's trying to, you know, do those creative, human, collaborative things that work to solve a problem? Are you seeing evidence of that anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, that's what does give me hope. So we did have many Shias helping us. And that's because they have got Sunni neighbors and they remember a time when there was intermarriage, when they lived side by side. And there are so many people on both sides who said, you know, we don't accept this sectarian violence. We don't accept the sectarian divide. We are one people. We're all Muslim. We're all Iraqis. And, you know, the vice president, we spoke to a vice president, Ayad Alawi, one of three vice presidents. He's Shia. And he spoke out against the Shia militia. And he sees himself as a secular man. And he says that he's blind to sectarian violence, and he'll call it out on both sides. So there are people on both sides working towards reconciliation.
And is he also the one who says this is not just an Iraqi problem, this is a problem that will spill over to the whole world? What does he mean by that?
He understands that there needs to be reconciliation and the Sunnis need to be given a place at the table. Yeah. And he says that until you do that, there will be Sunni insurgencies. There will be Sunnis fighting for their rights and they'll be fighting with violence. And he is a pragmatist, and he says that, you know, you can say that you've beaten ISIS and you've beaten the problem, but you haven't. Let's look deeper, and that's why he's trying to build bridges with the Sunni community. And actually, a lot of the people who voted for him, a chunk of the electorate voted for him, are actually Sunnis.
Mm. Compelling stuff. We've been talking with award-winning journalist Ramita Navai. You can see Frontline Iraq Uncovered on SDPB TV Tuesday, March 21st at 9 p.m. Central, 8 Mountain. Ramita Navai, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.